Welcome to Burrows and Burbs with hosts John Engel and Roberto Cabrera. Over the next hour, you're going to learn some insider knowledge that will help you overcome and strategize in the cutthroat world of real estate. Now, here are your hosts, John and Roberto.
John.
Welcome. Welcome, everybody. Episode 107 of Burrows and Burbs. I think we're into our fourth year already. Welcome, Roberto Cabrera from headquarters. Are you in New York or are you in the Hamptons?
No, I'm in New York. I'm in my daughter's bedroom, actually.
All right. I am in lovely Palm Beach at the Breakers, where I'm at a real estate conference, so I can write the whole thing off. It's one of the great, benefits of being a real estate investor, which we're going to learn about over the next hour, being a real estate investor and writing off your trips to Palm Beach. But before I get started, let me introduce my two guests. I've got Chris Stout of Stout Capital. Say hello.
How you doing? How's it going?
And I've got Joel Farrell, but I don't see him on yet, so maybe he's having trouble connecting. But we'll connect with Joel from Strive for 25 in a minute. But before we begin, I just want to give a shout out to our sponsor, Grace Farms, gracefarms.org. They are an incredible 80-acre campus in New Canaan, Connecticut. They have initiatives for the arts and environment. And what we're interested in on this show is their Design for Freedom campaign, which is trying to clean up the building industry and provide a ethical sourcing of building materials. So for more on that, go to designforfreedom.org and learn more about it. Now let's begin. Chris Stout, tell us about Stout Capital. One of the few things I heard was, I said, what kind of a real estate investor is Chris Stout? And they said that your particular expertise, or one of your particular expertise, is syndication. So tell us about yourself and what does syndication mean?
I think he's frozen.
Okay. Chris, are you frozen?
I think he is.
I think he's frozen with a frowny face on. Okay, that's not good. Chris, you still there? All right. Roberto, what do you think we're going to talk about today while we unfreeze?
But the first thing, when you talk about investment, you got to think about why real estate investment first, right? As opposed to, you know, anything else, because it really tends to be, in the way I've always looked at it, as a long-term investment, right? It's not just about, you're not going to trade this thing in a couple of days or in a couple of weeks, but much further down the road. Now we have Chris back.
I'm back. I was first concerned if it was me or you, and I guess it was me.
All right. Well, so, I'm glad to have you back. But we were asking, Tell us about yourself and tell us about syndication.
Yeah. So, thanks for having me on the show. So, yeah, Chris Stout, my name of my company, Stout Capital, where we now own and operate $50 million worth of apartments. And it's just about 500 units. By the end of the month, it'll be almost 600 apartment units. I started buying apartments about 14 years ago, entirely by myself. So no investors, no partners, just grinding, assembling apartments, buying them. At the same time, I was building custom houses. So I would take all the custom house money and put it into apartments. Time went on. We built it to a spec home building company. So we're using past relationships and building an investor base through past relationships in the custom home building company to build spec homes. And someone asked me, like, why don't you let me in your apartments? And the interesting thing about apartments is to, like, hard money lending, which would be the other side of, they were investors or hard money lenders, depending on how it was set up, is hard money's fast, right? So you're kind of cycling through it every 12 to 18 months, the money's back and you have to send it back out. Where apartment investing is more of a long-term type investment where things could, you know, the investment term typically lasts 6 to 7 to possibly 8 years. So it's for individuals who want their money in real estate, want the capital protection, want the tax benefits, love the cash flow, but don't want the risk of putting the money in the stock market where, you know, your capital, your principal is always at risk. So syndication is a business that allows individuals into these larger apartment deals without doing really any of the work. Because a lot of people, you know, people like to call real estate into a passive investment, but it's not passive, really. You know, if you own real estate, the money just doesn't show up every month, like the internet or TV shows want to tell you. You know, there's a lot of work that goes behind making sure that that money lands in the account every month. So whether it be, you know, making sure the tenants pay, dealing with the requests that goes on throughout the entire month, managing the deal, selling it, buying it, just there's such a tremendous amount of work that goes behind it. It's almost, when you get deep into it, it's almost laughable that it's called a passive investment. But with all that being said, the most passive form of real estate investing is getting involved in real estate syndication if you want to be a direct owner of a property. So being a direct owner of a property is beneficial mainly because you get the deduction, where if you invest in a REIT, you're kind of invested in deals, but you're not a direct owner. So you're not taking advantage of the deductions. It's basically just buying a stock that's backed by real estate, right? So real estate syndication, you're finding an operator that you say, all right, this guy or gal knows what they're doing. This group knows what they're doing. They're going out to buying larger deals. So there's more stability in larger deals than there is smaller deals. You know, I started with two families. That was my kickoff. But really, time goes on, you realize that they're definitely a stable investment, but they're not the most stable form of real estate investing because, you know, in a two family house, if you lose one tenant, you're 50% vacant. God forbid you lose two. Now you're 100% vacant. And so all you got to do is lose two tenants, which is easy to happen. Now the real estate deal is all of a sudden costing money out of your pocket, which isn't the goal. So now we buy these large assets. So 5 to 15 million dollar assets. We're typically putting together 50 to 100 apartment units, sometimes more. We've purchased apartment units up to 146 units. So we like to stay in that. We get the economies of scale. We get the better property managers. So we have real quality property managers watching the day-to-day of these things. We're asset managing. So we're dealing with these assets on a weekly basis. We're dealing with them all week, but with the property manager meeting is a weekly meeting, random emails throughout the week. And we split the profits with our investors. And, you know, it's really as simple as that. We're going to buy apartment buildings that are already occupied in growing markets, optimizing the rents and expenses, and letting it simmer for the investment term. And everyone gets paid, and it's a great thing, and we get paid to manage it.
I have so many questions.
Yeah. So much to unpack.
So much to unpack. Let's start with a passive investment. You did talk about, allude to the fact that there's property management and then there's the asset management. Talk to us about how you pick a property manager, but more importantly, the financial breakdown. So if you're looking at a piece of property, what are you estimating the property management should cost? And the asset management, does that also come with a cost?
Yeah, so the property manager, depending on how many units there are, it will be flexible of how much the property manager costs. So on a 50 to 100 unit deal, or I should say 50 to 75, 80, once you start getting closer to 100, it changes. So say, well, 50 to 75, you're paying 5% of gross receivables and a small shared employee. So the small shared employee, and it's typical because units, apartment buildings under 100 units don't have on-site staff. It's a leasing office that's remote and then a part-time maintenance guy. It's because there's not enough going on at the property to have a full-time maintenance person. So for us to pick a property manager, it's a very difficult process for the property manager to get chosen by us, because we're literally interviewing all of the top property managers in an area. We're visiting their office. We're checking to see how they handle their financials, how they handle their maintenance, how they handle their Maintenance requests is a big thing. We want to see how quickly they handle maintenance requests, because that'll actually trickle down to how occupied our building stays. The number one reason people leave apartments is because they're unhappy with the maintenance. So if an air condition breaks, how long is it hot in the apartment? Do you repair it in a week, 2 weeks, overnight? Is it done the next day? So these are all things that we go through before we pick a property manager. And I've actually have never had it that we've hired a property manager after going through that program that we regret our decision. So our property managers are spectacular. From an asset management standpoint, that's us. So we're managing the property manager, and that's an asset manager position. So now we're making decisions. Do we push? So it's kind of like they're spending our money, best way of saying it. So they can't go out and make high-end, high-level decisions without our approval. So, hey, we have some vacancies coming up. Do you want to charge $1,100 or $1,300? If you pick $1,300, the apartment could stay vacant for a little bit longer, or we may not get anybody in it. $1,100, well, we'll get someone in immediately, but we also might have left some money on the table. So it's up to us as asset managers to dial that up or down. So our main focus of asset management is, where do we spend our CapEx money? What are we repairing? Because if a parking lot, say a parking lot needs to be updated or seal coated, or the parking lot needs improvement, does it disable the apartment building if a parking lot isn't kept up? No, but it will turn the dial up or down on revenue, or it may not. So we have to decide, do we put $100,000 into the parking lot? Do we get an ROI on that money? So we have to make sure that every single thing we do, we're getting an ROI on the money, where the property manager might say, hey, I think you guys should power wash the back of the building. And we say, well, how much is that going to cost? $7,500? All right. Is that going to change the ROI? Are we going to get an ROI on that? Like, well, probably not. So, all right, so we're not going to do it. So we have to make sure that the money we spend, we're making money on it. And I think when a lot of people own real estate themselves, so if they invest in their own real estate as opposed to investing with us, we professionally treat every dollar with no emotion. So we literally go in this, and a buddy of mine who owns another syndication company said he's more vertically integrated, where he has his own property management in-house, which I don't agree with it, but he tells the tenants, I'm the first heart donor in the world. So basically what he's telling everybody is, I don't have a heart. We're just doing business here. So all of our decisions are strictly made. Do we make money on decision or do we not? And I could say, like, in the beginning of me running apartments, in my early days of owning, operating apartments by myself, I would hold on to buildings for too long and I would over-improve apartments. Whereas if I would have put thousands of dollars less in the apartment, I would have gotten the same rent. So we're constantly making decisions to make sure that we're optimizing the deal.
What is the cost of the asset manager, given that it's 5% off the top for the property manager?
So asset management fee actually comes directly to us. And we charge, depending on the deal, but it typically varies. It floats around 3%.
But because you're so unemotional and efficient, you make that 3% back like that.
Yeah.
The individual who makes some bad decisions and puts money into things that don't produce an ROI.
Yeah. So if you take an example, our deal that we're closing, we're raising for a deal right now as we speak. It's 48 units in Rogers, Arkansas, which is right next to Fayetteville, Arkansas. We have 56 units there. So combined, it's a nice 100-unit package. The deal, the asset manager fee works to be about 20-something thousand a year. So at 20-something thousand a year, we make one right decision and we blow that 20,000 out of the water. And it's a fairly small fee for us to manage the thing for the entire year. Owning a business, you could tell 20,000 to cover costs really doesn't do anything. The way we make money is we make money at the tail end of the fund. So the way these funds are set up is the investor gets paid first, we get paid second. So there's a preferred return. So the preferred return is 6%. So that means that the investor, no matter what, gets the first 6% that the deal kicks off. And that accrues. So if the deal doesn't produce 6% the first year, we now owe them 6% the second year and the remaining, whatever is left from the first year. And as we catch up and the deal progresses and it starts kicking off more than 6%, which usually happens somewhere in the, depending on the deal, somewhere in the neighborhood of year two, it starts kicking off greater than 6%. That's when we split that profit 70-30, 70 to investors, 30 to us. And as the deal gets, as the deal progresses even further, it starts to kick off much more than 6%. And that's how we average an annualized return of 16%. Over the course of the investment. So if you take all the earnings you made over 6 years and divide it by six, well, then it usually lays out to be between 15 and 16%. And that's including sales proceeds.
I love this. I got some follow-up questions, but I do want to introduce Joel Farrell. Wave your hand, Joel. Joel from Strive for 25, our co-guest today. But on that topic, so let me just repeat what I think you just said. So I put $1 million into your fund. I should expect a 6%, 60 grand. I'm a retiree. I'm depending on a steady stream of income. The projection is that I get the preferred investment and I'm going to get a $5,000 check every month, 60 grand, 60 grand for every year and more if it's doing well. Do most of your investments do well up front, or do they take a while to get to that total rate of return of 16%?
So I'll answer that two different ways. The goal of every investment is to return twice the amount of money over 6 years. So if you invest $1 million, you're going to see $2 million by the end of 6 years. Somewhere in the middle of that, depending on the deal, and I can let you know the deal it's active, the answer is year two. Somewhere in the middle of it, we refinance and we get you a percentage of the money back. So this specific deal, by year two, we get you 40% of the money back. So if you invest $1 million, by year two, you get a check back for 400 grand. Now, after that cash out, you still retain the same equity percentage of the deal. Over the course of the investment, you're getting monthly dividend checks of 6%, and then whatever's after six, we split 70-30. And most deals start to pay on an average about month eight, seven or eight. So real estate, a lot of real estate deals, unless we're buying like class A without that much value add. If we're buying a value add piece of real estate, which where the most of the money is, we're buying a value add piece of real estate. We need to buy it. And we need some time to execute a bit of a business plan. So if we bought something that cash flows immediately, typically the upside is limited. Whereas if we purchase something that doesn't cash flow immediately, the upside is much more, but we need a little bit of time to get there. So it's kind of, we buy an asset, are we willing to work for free for 6 months so we build a cash register for the next 5.5 years? Yes. Are we looking to buy assets that cash flow from today? We would love it, but there's a good chance that there's something wrong with it. Meaning something wrong with it we can't fix. So what can't we fix? We can't fix a bad location. So a lot of assets that you buy and cash flowing very strongly today, well, there's a good shot that there's a whole bunch of other people who aren't buying it for that for a different reason that you can't fix, which is location. So we shy away from that because this is all long-term stuff. So if it's easy, there's a saying that we have, if it's easy to get, well, I probably heard it somewhere and just adopted it. If it's easy to get into, it's going to be hard to get out of. So typically the assets that we get into, it's no short of a fist fight to get into it. And if we win that fight, now we know we have an asset that when we go to sell it, someone else will be fist fighting each other to get out of, to buy it. So just as if we're concerned about the exit more than we are the cash flow every month.
Chris, what you described is almost like win-win. Either this way or that way, win-win. Where's the risk and how do you measure that?
So the risk is, okay, so Where's the risk in multifamily? Well, people want to stop living indoors. Where would they want to stop living indoors? Maybe areas that we have a declining population. So we stay away from that. So we're not going to have a vacancy risk. The largest risk in this business is interest rate risk. So we're able to mitigate it, but we can't completely eliminate it. So how do we mitigate it? Well, we get long-term debt on properties when we're stabilized. Could it happen that we go through the investment term, which is 6 years? What we say is 6 years. And the reason I say that is we're not forced to sell in year six. It behooves everybody to sell in year six, as long as things are going the way we like. If for some weird reason the world is in shambles in 6 years, and it's obvious that it's not a good time to sell real estate, well, then we'll hold it. And we'll just keep, everyone will just keep getting paid. Your principal's protected. You keep getting your monthly check. And we'll sell it whenever time is good. If interest rates were to shoot up to 15%, say, well, now we're going to have a cap rate expansion where it's going to be difficult to get out of real estate at the price you'd like. But what we like to do is we like to go back in time, look over history, see what's happened in the past and judge that going forward. And we take what we know, we implement it and we say, all right, we're going to go forward with this investment. We're accepting the risk that goes along with it. And the risk is real estate starts to go backwards in one way or another, where all of a sudden properties are getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper every year instead of more expensive. And we're willing to take that risk. And I'm willing to take that risk far more than betting on some random company that I don't know what's going on with in the stock market. And I mean, it's been proven over history that real estate over a period of time is a good investment. And I think that it's especially strong. And what's able to mitigate the risk is we don't have to do anything with this thing. We don't have to get out of it. And another way to mitigate the risk is we'll just, if for some reason 6 years is, if the world's in a bad place, we'll keep it as long as we have to until it fixes itself.
Let me ask you this. What's changed in the dynamic? Like 18 months ago, a good deal looked like this. Now in this environment, what's different that still makes a deal look good to you?
So we basically go in with similar assumptions. We just forecast a more grim outcome. So it was said, and a lot of people got caught saying this 2 to 3 years ago, that interest rates will not go up for a long period of time. And we took it for granted that interest rates remained low as long as they did. But people were like, no, it's good. It's going to stay like this forever. And I think that's a very bad way to look at it. So the way we go into deals now is we say, well, things are headed on a certain track and we count that they're going to get a little bit worse. So with that being said, if a deal looks good from that perspective, well, now we're okay getting involved with that deal, because whereas 2 years ago, you didn't really have upside, market upside. You only had upside that you were able to bring to the property and then just natural appreciation. But you weren't able to take advantage of market upside is like cap rate compression. Cap rates were compressed. You're not going to get lower than a 3 cap. You know, they're giving out loans at a 2.5% interest rate. You're buying a 3 cap. You can't get any better than that. So now if we're buying assets and in 6 months we have a 7 cap on our hands, well, there's a really, really good bet that cap rates for multifamily, good stabilized multifamily, will see 5% cap rates again. 5% cap rate is totally acceptable over a course of a long period of time. A 5 cap in multifamily is very acceptable. So we have confidence, and we don't underwrite this, by the way. We don't underwrite this happening, but if we have a deal that pencils of us thinking that the future will continue on the current path, and if it doesn't, for some reason, things continue to get worse, and by 6 years, they're like, all right, we're in a good time again. We're going to do significantly better than we thought. So
one question about that five cap. So back to my $1 million example. So you bought $1 million with an apartment building and you are hoping that the net operating income, what you return to investors, is 50 grand, right? That's 5% of that $1 million every year. What is your expectation for capital appreciation in addition to free cash flow from rents?
Is that part of
what you're calculating when you buy these and you're like, well, I'm only going to make 5%, but I expect this building to double in value over the next 10 years. Is that part of your thinking?
Yeah. So we look at the asset, we look to see what we could turn it into market rate. So we have to bring all the income to market rate. And now what do we do from that point? How are we going to let the building, how is the building going to appreciate from there? And capital appreciation is taken into consideration at a 3% annual rent escalator. So we say over the course of the investment, every year that goes by, this asset will, the rental income will increase by 3%. Over the course of history, pre-COVID, that was the right number. During COVID, it accelerated high. And we're actually looking specifically in markets that didn't see that ultimate rush. So actually are still a little bit behind because what markets saw like wild increases? Florida as almost a whole, New York City just seen is, I mean, it's almost impossible to rent an apartment in New York City. I just heard on a phone call earlier that to rent a studio apartment is $3,500.
Can be
crazy. Or one bedroom apartment is $4,000. Crazy.
Or five.
There you go.
Kay and I saw an apartment that was, they weren't selling it. And the owner was just like, we'll just rent it. I said, what are you going to ask? He said like 5,400. They rented it in one day for 5,900.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So I mean, the hike in rents has shown its face in a lot of markets, and a lot of markets, it kind of lags behind a little bit just because they're not, you know, it's not the hottest place to live in the country, which, you know, New York and Florida and parts of California, maybe Phoenix, like there's a couple of them that you would name that like really cool places to live. Dallas and Houston is definitely not one of them. You go there to work. That's it. There's nothing cool to do there. My opinion. I've been there a bunch of times. I don't see anything to do there, but, so with that being said, I mean, we count on standard rent appreciation and so here's another thing to mention. So doubling the value of the building, we don't have to double the value of the building. We have to double the value of the equity. So if we buy a $10 million building, costs us $4 million to close it, we need the value of the building to go up by $4.5 million to double our money. So if we buy a building at 10 million, we need to sell it at 14 and a half million to double our money. We don't have to sell it at 20. So, cause we're using leverage. So the bank has a good portion of the debt the bank has a good portion of it and all they want is their interest rate. So, you know, these are all things to consider when you're getting into an investment. You're saying, well, the rate of return here, the preferred rate of return here is 6%. Why don't I just put my money in the bank for 5.5% with no risk? Well, if you get into a real estate deal now, by the time the bank takes that interest rate away, which they will, because they're not paying you 5.5% because they like you, they're paying it to as a distraction to keep you out of other things. So, and the bank pays as little, the bank pays you as little as they have to pay you. So they're trying to keep you out of other opportunities. So when that goes away and you still have your money, it could have been in an investment starting a year ago, which is now returning 6%+. Whereas the guy who put his money in the bank safe for 5.5% now just has his money, no opportunity. And the bank said, well, we're back to a half a point on your checking account.
All right, let me pivot to Joel. Joel, why don't you tell us a little bit about Strive for 25? And is this syndication model something that you're pursuing or do you have an alternative?
Yeah. So Chris being in the syndication part of it, that's kind of a different lane. Mine, I guess you would say would be kind of a stair step up on the way to that level. A lot of the stuff, so I'm in St. Louis, Missouri. And I'm an originator on the lending side. I've been in the business since 2006. I'm licensed in 20 from DC, Virginia, Carolinas to Florida to Texas, Midwest, do a little bit in California. So I do see a lot of different markets, what's going on in terms of trends and prices and people in different stages of their journey. And one of the things that I'm seeing a lot, like on the lending side, there's three profiles of people who are doing things right now. And there's literally no in between: first time homebuyers, investors, and then someone who has to do something because of a life change, divorce, death, something like that. And the investor side of things is so interesting. Just like when I have a podcast, just like John does. And I went into the podcast thinking, I'm going to go get leads for my business. And my perspective quickly changed within about 3 or 4 months. It's about relationships and doors opening. You know, that's the thing I just never even imagined. And so when I say doors opening, you know, I met Chris through social media. I met John through, you know, social media. And, you know, this out-of-state investor buying across state lines was something that wasn't very common however many years ago, especially when I was getting, busier in my career in the early 2010s, 12, 13. And so I'm seeing people purchase in Florida and they may live in Houston. I'm seeing people live in Hawaii, buying in Pittsburgh, buying single family properties, fix and flips, and scaling that way. People buying in Toledo, Ohio, people buying in Missouri, St. Louis. And so, the type of
profile. And not relying on Chris Stout to pick the asset and not relying on Chris Stout to pick the property manager. You're saying that your friends in St. Louis are buying properties in Florida because that's the gold rush and managing them themselves one at a time. How's that going?
I mean, it's one of these things where right now it's not great. Like I look at I have a short-term rental that's in Florida and my insurance has tripled. My taxes have doubled. And if I would have bought in 2022, I'd be in tough shape, but I bought a few years before that. So I got in at a good equity and price position. And so, the people that I talked to, like I was putting this on social media, you know, DSCR loan. It's a loan for someone to be able to use just the cash flows on a property. And DSCR, you know, don't jump into these waters if you're a rookie. You need to be using these types of loans if you're a seasoned investor who knows the game, who knows how to price out a deal, that can underwrite a deal and have that margin for it. Because just like Chris said, I love how Chris is talking about the time frame. Like, you know, you're buying into this investment and it's a 6-year vehicle. Yeah, we are in headwinds right now with where rates are. And so you put money in treasuries, maybe getting that for, you know, 6 months or a year. And then what happens in the year? What do you do with your money? And it's like, if you can get into a deal right now, you may not like the investors that I see that are buying in Florida in the last 3 years. You know, what's unique about that type of panhandle short-term rental market is that it's a dual use. You put money into an investment, you can get a return on your dollar, but you can also use it from a personal standpoint in terms of having fun with your family, going to vacation, be on the crystal white sand beaches, go there in the off season to be able to get away. So it's not just dollars and cents in that market. It's personal. It's aesthetics. It's intangible things you can't put a number on. And so people get in and they're looking at it from a long-term perspective. And so, rates, when I got in the business in 2006, we were at like 7% rates. And I'm talking to people. I have an IT guy who has, well, for a couple of years, had 3 full-time jobs, just got the screens up, doing all these things, making money, making a couple $100,000 a year on each job. And he bought 4 properties across 37 months, all as primary residences. And this is something I talk about. I wish I had my book with me. But I use the term stair step method. It's where, hey, someone can purchase a primary residence, low money down, 5% down, for example. And every market's going to be different in terms of the price points, right? Like New York is going to be different than St. Louis. DC or Virginia is going to be very different than, say, Wilmington, North Carolina. But that doesn't mean
I hope this has a happy ending. The guy with 3 jobs buys 4 properties without a property manager. I hope this has a happy ending.
Well, he got into the game in 2021, and all he's ever known was a 3% rate. And the last one he bought was at 6.875. And it's just like blowing his mind. 6.875, it's double what my first ones were. Like, what am I going to do? When are rates going to come back down? I'm like, I don't know, but it doesn't matter. It's all about time in the game. Not
is he
time.
Cash flow negative?
What did you say? He bought them all as primaries.
Mm-hmm.
meaning that he's moving.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
he's a free agent. He can work remotely, so he can literally, he bought in North Carolina as a primary residence. And when you sign that paperwork, you're basically saying, I'm going to live there for at least 12 months. Life changed. He actually moved to Houston, Texas, bought as a primary residence, put 5% down, lived there for technically about 11 months. And then life change happened. He had a growing family, moved to a bigger home, turned the old one into a rental, lived there for 12 months, and then did it again. So each time putting 5% down, primary residence interest rates. And then, you know, those rates were evolving from threes to fours, which, you know, again, those were, anything below 3.25 is all time low. We never saw 3.25 rate until COVID. That's a COVID rate, you know, 2.25, 2.75, whatever. And he has one of those. But cash flow, yeah. I mean, from a long-term rental standpoint, you know, cash flowing a little bit and, you know, it's not great. Taxes and taxes are high. but 30 years on the road, he'll have properties paid off. And that's it. That's his strategy. He's just trying to plant those seeds.
You know, so that's a buy and hold strategy. This is a guy who's looking 20 years out and he just wants to amass a large portfolio. And he's happy if he can just break even on the cash flow. And he's looking for the capital appreciation at the end, perhaps.
That's right.
Okay.
And a little bit of tax incentive.
What do you think of that, Chris Stout?
You know, one thing just about the rates, and I like the way Joel said it. The rates, 2% or 3% was done. That was performed to save a potentially collapsing world. How do we save it? We put unprecedented things in place to save everything. So to say rates will go back down, I think everyone has to be okay with buying at the now and today and what goes on today. And if things get better, great. If they don't, that's fine too. We're buying as if today is the new normal and it might get a little tighter. As far as buying and moving around the country, it seems like a labor intensive thing. You could go even crazier and say, well, you live there for 2 years. And the rule to absorb the tax benefit of selling your primary residence is you got to live there too within the last 5 years. You got to live there for at least 2 years within the last 5 years. So now you don't pay any tax if you sell it. But buying properties scattered and then paying them down and letting them appreciate and selling them in one day, compared to what we do, that's the exact opposite of what we're trying to do. That's a very labor intensive, very.
So can we talk about, this is about real estate investing for kind of the average person. So the way I would think of this is you kind of want to, you know, your first property, we're not talking about 50 units or anything like that, but your first property, I would think you'd want to buy that somewhere local, something somewhere familiar to you.
Yeah.
And then you start to expand from there. And like, what region are you in? You talked about something in Oklahoma.
Kansas. So I could tell you, so this is so for the beginning investor, this is exactly my opinion. If you want to start investing in real estate, do not look outside of where you live. It's completely preposterous to think that you're going to take on this new business or this new venture as a real estate investor and think you could do it remotely in a market you don't know anything about. It's a crazy idea. It's significantly easier to start this business, honing in on your market, knowing that, Main Street, a lot of stuff goes down on Main Street. You do not want to be there. Oklahoma Street down the block, every house surrounding Oklahoma Street is worth $2 million. Like, you know, so let's try to buy a couple blocks away. Like, you know the market better than anybody. Operate in your own backyard. Robert Kiyosaki said, buy something within 2 hours of your house. I would say keep it within an hour of where you live. And my thing was, when I started looking for deals, when I was in deal, now I live in deal buying mode. But when I was younger and I was like, okay, I have money, I saved up enough, I'm ready to buy something else. My thing was, look for 2 to 3 hours a day. Everyone, for the most part, has an extra 2 to 3 hours a day. Eliminate something else out of your life, whether it be I don't know, the million things that we do to waste time. And stare at the screen for 2 to 3 hours a day looking in one specific market. And what happens is you learn it so well that when a good deal pops in the market, it comes out of the screen and it punches you right in the face. Literally, you feel it. You see it and you're like, that's a deal. I don't have to do the math on it. I don't have to do anything on it. I know that's a good deal. I could tell by the way the building looks. I could tell by how many units it is. I could tell by the block it's on. I know it's not across the street from the bus depot. That's a good deal. And that's how you get started. So the idea of venturing off into other markets, now I'm operating on the Southeast and the South. These buildings for me now with the experience are just as easy for me to operate a deal as if it was in that building across the street that I could see where I'm sitting. And I would probably visit them the same just because my process and procedure and employees that I have operating these things, I wouldn't visit that building across the street any more than I would visit one that's in North Carolina, just because it doesn't matter where this thing exists at this point. We have a team and a staff to operate it, but that comes with time. So I would look at a guy like me when I first started, and I would start looking throughout the country. And I'm like, I never got anywhere. And I'm like, why am I not getting anywhere? It's like, because you don't know what, you don't even know what a good deal looks like. How are you going to find one in a market you've never been to? So operating within your own backyard and forgetting about everything else is definitely the best advice I could give anybody. And if anyone's ever bought out of state one unit and's been successful at it, well, check their books to make sure they're not lying, number one, because there's a good chance that they're either lying or they don't know. They know what their numbers were going in, but they don't know what they really made. Like, how many businesses don't know what they really made? Like, they just know that there's more money in the account this month than there was last month. That's all they know. So you went in thinking you were going to do a 15% return, but you're only doing a 4. Did you know that? They're like, oh, no, I guess I didn't realize how much the roof cost this year.
We lied to ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, I can tell really you the one place I still lie to myself, and I'm doing it right now, is building my own house. I'm building my own house here in Jersey. And I'm like, oh, I could get it done for this number. And then sure enough, like, we blow the budget. But it's because, you know, we're like, sure, do this. I know this idea is going to lose money, but the pool's going to look really cool with the LED lights in it. So, you know, but outside of that, you got to make sure that you're not listening to someone who's lying to himself. So
all right, Russell's got a question. He's a CEO, very smart, probably your next investor. Go ahead, Russell.
Yeah. Chris and Joel and everyone, Roberto, thank you. Chris, I just had a question because we look at cap rates all the time, and 5% on an NOI seems very, very low. And the reason I say that is if you have, I'm just using round numbers. If you have something that's producing $500,000 NOI, and you look at a 25-year amortization at 5.5%, which seems like a good rate, that's $736,000 a year, which is higher than the NOI. So I'm wondering what, number one, you know, I wouldn't invest, me personally, or buy something in this market with the interest rates being what they are at a 0.05 cap rate. That's number one. And number two, what on a $10 million deal at that multiple, what do you need to buy down in terms of equity investors in order to get your numbers that work? I mean, even if you took the 10 down to 5 because you got 5 people putting $1 million in, that still brings it to that $368,000 a year on something that's only kicking out 500. There's not enough room in there to kick it out for the investors that are coming in. So I like looking at real numbers. And when you threw out a cap rate of 0.5%, I understand a cap rate of 0.5%. We were at 2.5% interest rates, but this doesn't work that way.
Yeah. So to clarify what I said, I could see multifamily in the future trading again for a 5% cap rate. So we're not, and what you're talking about is negative leverage. So you're buying at a lower cap rate than you're borrowing the money at. So we only buy negative leverage, and we're talking about the course of time. For as long as it's been measured, multifamily, we'll see a 5% cap rate again. So we're just saying, what I was saying was, is if we're buying a 6% cap rate today, we also have the opportunity, amongst other things, to take advantage of the cap rates going from 6 to 5 again in the future. So
even at 6%, 6%, I'm at $614,000 on an $8.3 million line. So I'm still not covering my NOI. So I think you'd have to be at like 12%, hoping that you're driving down to 5.
So
I'm not seeing how the numbers don't work at that level.
On the commercial loans, we're only paying interest. We got interest only debt. Very common for commercial. So if we borrow $1 million, we're paying $100,000 a year. If we borrow a million bucks and we have a 6% interest rate, we're paying $60,000 a year. We don't pay principal on these loans. We never want to pay principal. Why would we pay principal? We'd rather eat that money, rather the money in our pocket than the banks. Principal pay down to me is useless when you're borrowing 65% leverage on a deal. We already paid you enough principal. We want to take the rest. So, you know, if we borrow at 65% leverage, we're in a very safe spot. So the value of the building for us to be in trouble would have to drop over 30%, which, you know, why would that happen? It's just the chance of that happening would be so remote. So basically, what you're talking about is a big metric for us. And you'll hear the terms positive leverage and negative leverage. Negative leverage means your cap rate is lower than the percent that you're buying at, which doesn't make sense. And we're always either buying at positive leverage or on a road to positive leverage, a clear path to positive leverage. So we want to borrow between 100 and 150 basis points lower than our stabilized cap rate. So 100 basis points is 1%. So we want to borrow at a 1 to 1.5% lower than our stabilized cap rate. As long as we could do that, we have a really strong path to success for us and our investors.
So Joel, how do you target properties? Where are you sitting now? And you're buying in Florida, right?
Yeah, I mean, I live in St. Louis. So I own here in St. Louis and also in Florida. And from the stuff that's working here locally, the fix and flippers are the ones that are probably making the most money. They're the ones finding deals. They've got all those routes and connections already built. There's a ton of off-market stuff that never hits the MLS that they're scooping up and, you know, turning into profit. So that's something.
And
that's
by the way, Roberto and I keep saying, learning on this show every week, that the projects in Connecticut are getting punished. Things that need work are getting punished in the marketplace. And Roberto's telling me the same thing is happening in New York City, right, Roberto? I mean, if it needs work, and I don't know if it's only economic. I think in many respects, the millennials who are coming into the market, by and large, don't have the experience or the confidence taking on projects. Or maybe they just don't have the time. And it's interesting that you're talking about identifying projects as the best opportunities. And we're hearing the same thing from Chris Stout. He said he's looking for things that may not return immediately that he may have to put some money into as his target. So you're saying, I think, the same thing. You're looking at projects as providing the best return.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And kind of talking about the millennials too, like the experience, ability to take on a project. You know, one of the things that, you know, that I'm seeing on the residential side is that inventory is at all time lows. You know, I think compared to 2008-2009, it's a 5-to-1 difference in terms of the amount of homes that are being sold right now. And people, I think 72% of people out there that own a home have a rate below 4% or own it free and clear. Like there's just such a small, I think only 9% of people out there have a mortgage that's, you know, above 6%. And so they have this logjam of inventory. People are not selling their house because they don't want to triple their payment with a higher rate and higher prices. And, you know, talking about multifamily, you know, the population across the US, I think, has gone up, you know, 10% in the last 15 years, from 300 million to 330. I forget the exact numbers. You know, the level of construction on the residential side for single family is slowing down. It's backlog, millions of numbers. So, I saw a stat that like the Gen Z demographic, a large percentage want to purchase a home in the next 5 years. Okay, cool. You want to buy a house, but that doesn't mean that you're going to be able to qualify to buy a house because the affordability metrics are out there have just gone skyrocketing. The average price of homes has gone up. The rates have gone up. The amount of money that you need has gone up. And I go back probably 4 years in a lot of markets in Maryland, Virginia, DC, Florida, Carolinas. You'd be able to get a certain amount of credits from a seller to cover closing costs. That doesn't exist anymore. There are some more of that coming in right now as things are sitting longer. So there's a higher level, a higher barrier to entry to get into owning your first house as a primary residence, even though you have, home buyer programs that are out there, but still there's a large barrier. And so when you fast forward the clock, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, you're going to have a generation or two that there's going to be a much smaller percentage of homeowners and more renters. And so we're talking about fix and flips and then multifamily. I mean, I see an opportunity there just in general, just as demographics shift in that regard. So that's just some.
I'm going to argue with you. I got a friend who bought one and then two, and then pretty soon he had 60 residential units in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And it was great until the market turned. And when the market turned, they stopped paying their rent. Enough of them stopped paying their rent in a recession. And he complained and he couldn't evict them. And when he finally did evict them, they trashed these units on the way out. And he said, "This is terrible. I don't care how good a deal it is. I'm never doing residential rentals again because the law is against me." And he went and bought mixed use. He owns in South Norwalk, and he bought light industrial. He bought office buildings, but because the law does not favor the residential landlord. So I'd love to hear Chris and yourself address that.
John, I have a good point to bring up just to cover on the. I want to just clarify. So the gentleman I was just talking to with the beautiful vertical windows in the background, I forget his name. What was his name?
Russ.
So Russ, you had mentioned you would almost need a 12 cap to try to make 6% on a deal that you're paying 6% debt on. I think that's what you were saying. So remember, we're only paying interest on a portion of the NOI or the portion of the building. So if we buy something and we take 65% debt on it, we're only paying 6% on the 65%. And remember, we're growing the NOI. So when we grow the NOI, the mortgage payment doesn't get any more expensive. So that's all free money. So the bank, when we make more money, the bank doesn't come along and say, "Hey, you guys are doing pretty well over there. Our mortgage payment just went up." So you're not partners with the bank. They're just loaning you a small percentage. So just to clarify that, because if someone listened to that, it does make sense. Like if you buy a 6 cap, if you buy a 12 cap and you pay the bank 6%, well, you make 6%. We're only paying interest on a small portion. And the whole thing.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Chris. And I did run an amortization table on the interest payment. It did reduce it some. We brought it down to like $364,000 against $500,000. You have to take off your two management fees, brings it to $460,000. Still is $100,000 off of $500,000, which is only about a 20%. So, I mean, I get where you're going. I get, grab the properties now at a much higher cap rate and then drive the cap rate down when it's time to flip it. And you hope you have those numbers built in. I just want to make sure that I was, that I was running the numbers correct.
Yeah. And we could chat offline if you wanted to check out some underwriting and see actually how it all works out.
All right. We have 1 minute. We have 1 minute to go. We got to have our final thoughts. I love the discipline of Chris Stout's approach. I love the fact that he's got a formula. I love the stair-step approach. It seems a little bit Wild West where, a little bit more emotional about buying a second home in Destin, Florida and hoping for the best over a longer period of time. Final thoughts, because we got about 30 seconds.
Well, this is one thing I was going to say. Chris mentioned buying your backyard. I agree with that. The majority of the time, there's always exceptions to the rule. You mentioned Connecticut and landlord friendly or not. I mean, I'm talking to people every day in certain states like California or Illinois, and a few others that these people are seeking out opportunities in other places. So if you live in San Francisco and you want to get into the game, it's going to be much more challenging to buy a rental there versus buying something in Ohio.
Yeah, you have to move. I started in New York and I had to buy in New York, and listen, it's just part of it. So just buy, take it on the chin, learn your stuff. Listen, just know that you're learning in the hardest and it gets easier from there.
Yeah, you got to start at entry level. That way you can withstand any issues.
If you take a punch from Mike Tyson, you could take a punch from anyone. So if you could own a rental in New York, you could own a rental anyway.
I think we're going to have you guys back on the show. I think there's a lot more to learn. I love the fact that we have a formula. I love the discipline. I love the conversation with Russ about cap rates. And I think that we should have a part two on this. So thank you very much, guys. This was a great hour.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having
me. Signing off from sunny Palm Beach. I'll see you back in the Big Apple pretty soon, Roberto.
Sounds good. And we're here for you, buddy. Take care, guys.
Bye, all.